Crusades Through Arab Eyes by Amin Maalouf, continued. Cassette 5, Side 2. Shahwar and Amalric, who expected Shirkul to arrive from the east, suddenly saw him surge up from the opposite direction. Worse yet, his camp on the west side of Cairo, near the pyramids of Giza, was separated from his enemies by the formidable natural obstacle of the great river. From this solidly entrenched camp, he sent a message to the vizier. "The Frankish enemy is at our mercy," he wrote. "Cut off from their bases. Let us unite our forces and exterminate him. The time is ripe. The opportunity may not arise again." But Shahwar was not content simply to reject this offer. He had the messenger executed and brought Shirkuh's letter to Amalric to prove his loyalty. Despite this gesture, the Franges still distrusted their ally, who they were sure would betray them the moment he had no further need of them. They believed that the time had come to take advantage of Shirkuh's threatening proximity to establish their authority in Egypt once and for all. Amalric asked that an official alliance between Cairo and Jerusalem be signed. Two knights who knew Arabic, not unusual among the Franges of the Middle East, repaired to the residence of the young Caliph al-Hadid. In an obvious effort to make an impression, Shahwar led them to a superb, richly decorated palace, which they walked through quickly, ringed by a phalanx of armed guards. Then the cortege crossed a vaulted hallway that seemed interminable, impervious to the light of day, and finally came to the threshold of an enormous sculptured gate, leading first to a vestibule and then to another gate. After passing through many ornamented chambers, Shahwar and his guests emerged into a courtyard paved with marble and ringed by gilded colonnades, in the center of which stood a fountain boasting gold and silver pipes. All around were brightly colored birds from the four corners of Africa. Here the escort guards introduced them to eunuchs who lived on intimate terms with the caliph. Once again they passed through a succession of salons, then a garden stocked with tame deer, lion, bear, and panthers. Then finally they reached the palace of al-Hadid. Barely had they entered an enormous room whose back wall was a silk curtain encrusted with gold, rubies, and emeralds, when Shahwar bowed three times and laid his sword on the floor. Only then did the curtain rise, and the caliph approached, his body draped in silk and his face veiled. The vizier went to him, sat at his feet, and explained the proposed alliance with the Franges. After listening in silence, al-Hadid, who was then only 16, endorsed Shahwar's policy. Shahwar was about to rise when the two Franges asked the Prince of the Faithful to swear that he would remain loyal to the alliance. The dignitaries surrounding al-Hadid were visibly scandalized by this demand. The caliph himself seemed shocked, and the vizier hastily intervened. The accord with Jerusalem, he explained to his sovereign, was a matter of life and death for Egypt. He implored the caliph to consider the request of the Franges not as a manifestation of disrespect, but only as symptomatic of their ignorance of Oriental customs. Smiling, against his better judgment, al-Hadid extended his silk-gloved hand and swore to respect the alliance. But one of the Frankish emissaries interrupted. "An oath," he said, "must be taken bare-handed, for the glove could be a sign of future betrayal." The hall was scandalized a second time. The dignitaries whispered among themselves that the caliph had been insulted, and there was talk of punishing the insolent Franges. But after a fresh intervention by Shahwar, the caliph, preserving his calm, removed his glove, extended his bare hand, and repeated word for word the oath dictated to him by Mori's representatives. As soon as this singular interview had been concluded, the Egyptians and Franges met to elaborate a plan to cross the Nile and decimate Shirkuh's army, which was then heading south. An enemy detachment, commanded by Amalric, was hard on his heels. Saladin's uncle wanted to create the impression that he was on the run. He was well aware that his major handicap was that he was cut off from his bases, and he therefore sought to put the pursuing army in the same position. When he was more than a week's march from Cairo, he ordered his troops to halt, and, in an impassioned harangue, told them that the hour of victory was at hand. The confrontation actually came on the 18th of March, 1167, near the town of Al-Babain, on the west bank of the Nile. The two armies, exhausted by their interminable race, threw themselves desperately into the fray, eager to get it over with once and for all. Shirkuh had assigned command of the center to Saladin, ordering him to retreat as soon as the enemy charged. Amalric and his knights rushed towards him, banners unfurled, and when Saladin pretended to flee, they pursued him ardently without realizing that the right and left flanks of the Syrian army had already moved in to cut off any possible retreat. Losses among the Frankish knights were heavy, but Amalric managed to escape. He returned to Cairo, where the bulk of his troops remained, firmly resolved to seek vengeance at the earliest opportunity. He and Shawar were already collaborating on preparations to lead a powerful army back south to Upper Egypt when some barely credible news arrived. Shirkuh had seized Alexandria, Egypt's largest city, situated in the far north of the country on the Mediterranean coast. What had happened was that immediately after his victory at Al-Babain, the unpredictable Kurdish general, without waiting even a single day, and before his enemies had time to recover their wits, had crossed the entire length of Egypt at dizzying speed from south to north, and had entered Alexandria in triumph, the population of the great Mediterranean port, hostile to the alliance with the Frange, greeted the Syrians as liberators. Shawar and Amalric, forced to keep pace with the hellish rhythm at which Shirkuh was waging this war, decided to lay siege to Alexandria. Food was so scarce in the city that within a month the populace, faced with the threat of famine, began to regret having welcomed the Syrian Expeditionary Corps. When a Frankish fleet arrived and moored alongside the port, the situation seemed hopeless. Nevertheless, Shirkuh refused to admit defeat. He turned over command of the troops in the city to Saladin, and then, assembling a few hundred of his best cavalry, organized a daring nocturnal sortie. He passed through the enemy lines at full speed and drove his troops, riding day and night, back to Upper Egypt. Meanwhile, the blockade of Alexandria was being steadily tightened. Famine was now compounded by epidemic and by daily catapult attacks. The command was a weighty responsibility for the 29-year-old Saladin, but the diversion organized by his uncle worked. Shirkuh was not unaware that Mori was anxious to wind up this campaign and get back to his kingdom, which was under constant harassment by Nur al-Din. By opening a second front in the south instead of allowing himself to be bottled up in Alexandria, the Kurdish general threatened to prolong the conflict indefinitely. He even fomented an uprising against Shawar in Upper Egypt, convincing many armed peasants to join him. Once he had enough troops, he moved towards Cairo and sent Amalric a cleverly worded message. "We are both wasting time here," he said in substance. "If the king would think things through patiently, he would understand that driving me out of this country would be in no one's interest but Shawar's." Amalric was convinced, and agreement was soon reached. The siege of Alexandria was lifted, and Saladin left the city to the salutes of a guard of honor. In August 1167, the two armies both left Egypt, just as they had 3 years earlier, returning to their respective countries. Nur al-Din, satisfied at having retrieved the best of his army, was now fed up with these futile Egyptian adventures. And yet, as if decreed by fate, the race for the Nile broke out yet again the following year. When he had left Cairo, Amalric felt it prudent to leave a detachment of knights behind, just to make sure that his alliance with the Fatimids was properly observed. One of their major duties was to oversee the city gates and to protect the Frankish functionaries assigned to collect the annual tribute of 100,000 dinars that Shawar had promised to pay the Kingdom of Jerusalem. Inevitably, the heavy tax burden, combined with the prolonged presence of this foreign force, aroused resentment among the citizenry. Public opinion steadily mounted against the occupiers. It was suggested, sotto voce, even within the caliph's own entourage, that an alliance with Nur al-Din would be a lesser evil. Behind Shawar's back, messages began to flow to and fro between Cairo and Aleppo. The son of Zangi, in no hurry to intervene, simply observed the reactions of the king of Jerusalem. The Frankish knights and functionaries stationed in the Egyptian capital, well aware of the growing hostility, were frightened. They sent messages to Amalric begging him to come to their aid. At first, the monarch hesitated. The wise choice would have been to withdraw his garrison from Cairo and be content with a neutral and inoffensive Egypt as his neighbor. But he was temperamentally inclined to the leaf in the dark. in October 1168, encouraged by the arrival in the Middle East of a large number of Occidental knights eager to crush the Saracen, he decided to throw his army against Egypt for the fourth time. This new campaign began with a slaughter as horrible as it was gratuitous. The Occidentals seized Bilbaiz and, without the slightest provocation, massacred the inhabitants, men, women, and children, Muslims and Christians of the Coptic Church. As Ibn al-Athir said quite correctly, if the Frange had acted differently in Bilbaiz, they could have taken Cairo with the greatest of ease, for the city's notables were prepared to surrender it. But when they heard of the massacres perpetrated in Bilbaiz, people decided to resist regardless. As the invaders approached, Shawa ordered that the old city of Cairo be put to the torch. 20,000 jugs of naphtha were poured onto market stalls, houses, palaces, and mosques. The inhabitants were evacuated to the new city, founded by the Fatimids in the 10th century, which comprised mainly palaces, administrative offices, and barracks, as well as the religious university of Al-Adza. The fire raged for 54 days. In the meantime, the vizier tried to keep open the lines of communication to Amalric in an effort to convince him to abandon this foolhardy enterprise. Shawar hoped to be able to achieve this without any fresh intervention by Shirkuh. But his faction in Cairo was losing strength. In particular, the Caliph al-Hadid had taken the initiative of dispatching a letter to Nur al-Din asking him to rush to Egypt's aid. In an effort to move the son of Zangi, the Fatimid sovereign enclosed some locks of hair with his missive. These, he explained, are locks of hair from my wives. They beseech you to come and rescue them from the outrages of the Frange. Nur al-Din's reaction to this anxious message has been preserved, thanks to particularly valuable testimony from Saladin himself, who is quoted by Ibn al-Athir. When the appeals from al-Hadid arrived, Nur al-Din summoned me and told me what was happening. Then he said, go and see your uncle Shirkuh in Homs and urge him to come at once, for there must be no delay. I left Aleppo, and a mile from the city I encountered my uncle, who was already on his way. Nur al-Din ordered him to prepare to leave for Egypt. The Kurdish general then asked his nephew to accompany him, but Saladin demurred. I answered that I was not prepared to forget the sufferings endured in Alexandria. My uncle then said to Nur al-Din, it is absolutely necessary that Yusuf go with me. And Nur al-Din thus repeated his orders. I tried to explain the state of financial embarrassment in which I found myself. He ordered that money be given to me, and I had to go, like a man being led off to his death. This time there was no confrontation between Shirkuh and Amalric. Impressed by the determination of the Cairenes, who were prepared to destroy their city rather than surrender it to him, and fearing that he could be attacked from behind by the Syrian army, the Frankish king withdrew to Palestine on the 2nd of January, 1169. 6 days later, the Kurdish general arrived in Cairo to be hailed as a savior by the population and the Fatimid dignitaries alike. Shawar himself even seemed elated, but no one was taken in. Although he had fought against the Frange during past weeks, he was still considered their friend, and he had to pay for it. On the 18th of January, he was lured into an ambush, sequestered in a tent, and then killed by Saladin himself, with the written approval of the Caliph. That same day, Shirkuh replaced him as vizier. But when he donned his brocade silk and went to his predecessor's residence to move in, he found the place empty. There was not even a cushion to sit on. Everything had been stolen as soon as the death of Shawar was announced. It had taken the Kurdish general 3 campaigns to become the real ruler of Egypt, but he was not to savor his pleasure for long. On the 23rd of March, just 2 months after his triumph, he was taken ill after an excessively sumptuous meal. He was seized by an atrocious sensation of suffocation and died within a few minutes. His death marked the end of an era, but also the beginning of another, one whose repercussions would be infinitely greater. Upon the death of Shirkuh, Ibn al-Athir reports, the advisers of the Caliph al-Hadid suggested that he name Yusuf the new vizier, because he was the youngest and seemingly the most inexperienced and weakest of the emirs of the army. Saladin was indeed summoned to the sovereign's palace, where he was given the title al-Malik al-Nasir, the victorious king, as well as the distinctive accoutrements of the vizier, a white turban stitched in gold, a robe with a scarlet-lined tunic, a jewel-encrusted sword, a chestnut mare with a saddle and bridle adorned with engraved gold and encrusted pearls, and many other precious objects. Leaving the palace accompanied by a great cortege, he headed for his official residence. Yusuf managed to establish his authority within a few weeks. He discharged the Fatimid functionaries, whose loyalty seemed doubtful, replacing them with his own close collaborators. A revolt among the Egyptian troops was severely crushed. Finally, in October 1169, he repelled an absurd Frankish invasion, again led by Amalric, who had arrived in Egypt for the fifth and last time, in the hope of capturing the port of Damietta in the Nile Delta. Manuel Comnenus, uneasy that one of Nur al-Din's lieutenants now stood at the head of the Fatimid state, had accorded the Franks the support of the Byzantine fleet, but in vain. The Rum did not have enough supplies, and their allies declined to furnish any additional assistance. Within several weeks, Saladin was able to open talks with them and persuade them to bring the ill-conceived venture to an end. By the end of 1169, Yusuf was the unchallenged master of Egypt. In Jerusalem, Mori set his hopes on forging an alliance with Shirkuh's nephew against the main enemy of the Frange, Nur al-Din. The king's optimism may appear misguided, but it was not wholly without foundation. Saladin soon began to distance himself from his master. He continually assured Nur al-Din of his loyalty and submission, of course, but real authority over Egypt could not be exercised from Damascus or Aleppo. Relations between the two men finally became dramatically tense. Despite his solid power base in Cairo, Yusuf never dared to confront his elder directly. Whenever the son of Zangi invited him to a face-to-face meeting, Yusuf would find some pretext to avoid it, not for fear of falling into a trap, but because he was afraid that he would weaken if he found himself in the presence of his master. The first serious crisis came during the summer of 1171, when Nur al-Din demanded that the young vizier abolish the Fatimid Caliphate. As a Sunni Muslim, the master of Syria could not allow one of his dependencies to remain under the spiritual authority of a heretical dynasty. He sent several messages to this effect to Saladin, who was nevertheless reluctant to act. He was afraid of offending the sentiments of the population, which was mainly Shi'i, and of alienating the Fatimid dignitaries. Moreover, he was not unaware that he owed the legitimacy of his rule to his investiture by the Caliph al-Hadid. He feared that by dethroning the Caliph, he would lose whatever formal sanction he had for his power in Egypt, in which case he would be reduced to the status of a mere representative of Nur al-Din. In any case, he considered the son of Zangi's insistence on the matter as an attempt to tighten his own political grip on Egypt, rather than an act of religious zeal. At the beginning of August, the master of Syria's demands that the Shi'i Caliphate be abolished became an imperious order. His back to the wall, Saladin prepared himself to deal with possible hostile reactions from the population and even drafted a public proclamation announcing the removal of the Caliph, but he still hesitated to publish it. Although he was only 20, al-Hadid was seriously ill, and Saladin, who was bound to him by close ties of friendship, could not bring himself to betray his confidence. Then, without warning, on Friday the 10th of September 1171, a citizen of Mosul visiting Cairo entered a mosque, climbed the pulpit ahead of the preacher, and said the prayer in the name of Abbasid Caliph. Curiously, there was no reaction, either at the time or in the following days. Was this man an agent sent by Nur al-Din to embarrass Saladin? Possibly. In any event, after this incident, the vizier could no longer postpone his decision, whatever his reluctance. The order was given that from the following Friday there was to be no further mention of the Fatimids in the prayers. Al-Hadid was then on his deathbed, half-conscious, and Yusuf forbade anyone to tell him the news. If he recovers, Saladin said, then there will be plenty of time for him to find out. If not, let him die untormented. As it happened, Al-Hadid expired a short time later, never having learned of the unhappy fate of his dynasty. As might well be expected, the fall of the Shi'i Caliphate, after 2 centuries of often glorious rule, was a source of great relief to the Assassins sect, which, ever since the days of Hassan ibn al-Sabah, had hoped that the Fatimids would shake off their lethargy and usher in a new golden age of Shi'ism. The adherents of the sect were so devastated when they saw this dream vanish forever that their commander in Syria, Rashid al-Din Sinan, known as the Old Man of the Mountain, sent a message to Amalric announcing that he and all his supporters were prepared to convert to Christianity. At the time, the assassins held several fortresses and villages in central Syria where they lived relatively peaceful lives, seemingly having renounced the spectacular operations of bygone years. Although Rashid al-Din still commanded well-trained groups of killers and devoted preachers, many of the sect's members had become law-abiding peasants, often even compelled to pay a regular tribute to the order of the Templars. By promising to convert, the old man hoped, among other things, that his flock would be exempted from the tribute, which only non-Christians had to pay. The Templars, who did not take their financial interests lightly, observed these contacts between Amalric and the assassins with some disquiet. When it seemed that an agreement was at hand, they decided to block it. One day in 1173, as several envoys of Rashid al-Din were returning from an audience with the king, the Templars laid an ambush and massacred them. There would be no further talk of conversion by the assassins. Quite apart from this episode, the abolition of the Fatimid Caliphate had another consequence, as important as it was unexpected. It invested Saladin with a political dimension he had hitherto lacked. Obviously, Nur al-Din had not foreseen any such result. The elimination of the caliph, instead of reducing Yusuf to the rank of a mere representative of the master of Syria, made him the effective sovereign of Egypt and the legitimate custodian of the fabulous treasures amassed by the defunct dynasty. Relations between the two men would now grow steadily more embittered. Soon after these events, Saladin led a daring expedition against the Frankish fortress of Shorbak, east of Jerusalem. As the garrison was about to capitulate, Saladin learned that Nur al-Din had just arrived with his own troops to participate in the operation. Without a moment's delay, Saladin ordered his men to break camp and to return to Cairo at a forced march. The pretext, explained in a letter to the son of Zangi, was that turmoil had supposedly broken out in Egypt, forcing a precipitate departure. But Nur al-Din was not deceived. Accusing Saladin of disloyalty and treason, he swore that he would personally travel to the land of the Nile to take matters in hand. The uneasy young vizier assembled his closest collaborators, among them his father, Ayyub, and asked them what attitude they thought he should take if Nur al-Din carried out his threat. When some of the emirs declared that they were ready to take up arms against the son of Zangi, and Saladin himself seemed to share their view, Ayyub intervened, trembling with rage. Speaking to Yusuf as though he were a mere factotum, he said, "I am your father, and if there is anyone here who loves you and wishes you well, it is I. But know this, if Nur al-Din came, nothing could ever prevent me from bowing before him and kissing the ground at his feet. If he ordered me to lop off your head with my saber, I would do it, for this land is his. You shall write this to him. I have learned that you wanted to lead an expedition to Egypt, but there is no need for you to do so. This country belongs to you, and you need only send me a charger or camel, and I will come to you a humble and submissive man." When the meeting was over, Ayyub gave his young son another lecture, this time in private. "In God's name, if Nur al-Din tried to take so much as an inch of your territory, I would fight to the death against him. But why allow yourself to appear overtly ambitious? Time is on your side. Let Providence act." Convinced, Yusuf sent the message his father had suggested to Syria, and Nur al-Din, now reassured, called off his punitive expedition at the last minute. But Saladin had learned something from this emergency, and shortly afterwards he sent one of his brothers, Turan Shah, to Yemen, his mission being to conquer this mountainous land in southwest Arabia to prepare a refuge for the Ayyub family, just in case the son of Zangi again considered taking control of Egypt. And Yemen was in fact occupied without much difficulty in the name of King Nur al-Din. In July 1173, less than 2 years after the missed rendezvous of Shorbak, a similar incident occurred. Saladin was leading an expedition east of the Jordan, and Nur al-Din assembled his troops and set out to meet him. But once again, the vizier was terrified at having to face his master directly, and hurriedly headed back to Egypt, claiming that his father was dying. In fact, Ayyub had just fallen into a coma after an accident in which he had been thrown from his horse. But Nur al-Din was unwilling to accept this new excuse. And when Ayub died in August, he realized that there was no longer anyone in Cairo in whom he had complete confidence. He therefore decided that the time had come to take personal charge of Egyptian affairs. Nur al-Din began preparations to invade Egypt and wrench it away from Salah al-Din Yusuf, for he had noted that the latter was shirking the fight against the Frange for fear of having to unite with him. Our chronicler here, Ibn al-Athir, who was 14 when these events occurred, takes a clear position in support of the son of Zangi. Yusuf preferred to see the Frange on his borders rather than be the direct neighbor of Nur al-Din. The latter therefore wrote to Mosul and elsewhere asking that he be sent troops, but as he was preparing to march to Egypt with his soldiers, God whispered to him the command that cannot be shunned. The ruler of Syria fell gravely ill, afflicted, it seems, by a very painful angina. His doctors prescribed bleeding, but he refused. "One does not bleed a man 60 years old, he said. Other treatments were tried, but nothing worked. On the 15th of May, 1174, it was announced in Damascus that Nur al-Din Mahmud, the Saint King, the Mujahid who had united Muslim Syria and enabled the Arab world to prepare for the decisive struggle against the occupier, had died. That night, all the mosques were filled with people who had gathered to recite verses of the Quran in his memory. In time, Saladin would come to be seen as Nur al-Din's continuator rather than his rival, despite their conflict during these latter years. For the moment, however, resentment was the dominant emotion among the relatives and close associates of the deceased, and they feared that Yusuf would take advantage of the general confusion to attack Syria. In an effort to gain time, they did not notify Cairo of the news, but Saladin, who had friends everywhere, sent a finely worded message to Damascus by carrier pigeon. "News has come to us from the accursed enemy regarding the master Nur al-Din. If, God forbid, it should be true, we must above all ensure that no division takes hold in our hearts and that no minds are gripped by unreason, for only the enemy would profit." In spite of these conciliatory words, fierce hostility would be aroused by the rise of Saladin. Chapter 10. The Tears of Saladin. "You go too far, Yusuf. You overstep all limits. You are but a servant of Nur al-Din, and now you seek to grasp power for yourself alone. But make no mistake, for we who have raised you out of nothingness shall be able to return you to it." Some years later, this warning delivered to Saladin by the dignitaries of Aleppo would seem absurd. But in 1174, when the new master of Cairo was just beginning to emerge as the principal figure of the Arab East, his merits were not yet evident for all to see. In Nur al-Din's entourage, both while he lived and just after his death, no one even spoke the name of Yusuf anymore. Words like the upstart, the ingrate, the disloyal, or most often the insolent, were used instead. Saladin himself generally shunned insolence, but his luck was surely insolent. And it was just this that annoyed his adversaries. For this 36-year-old Kurdish officer had never been an ambitious man, and those who knew him from the beginning felt sure that he would have been quite content to be no more than an emir among others, had fate not propelled him, willy-nilly, to the forefront of the scene. He had accompanied his uncle to Egypt somewhat reluctantly, and his role in the conquest had been minimal. Nevertheless, just because of his self-effacement, he was drawn to the summit of power. He himself had not dared to proclaim the downfall of the Fatimids, but when he was forced to do so, he found himself heir to the richest of Muslim dynasties. And when Nur al-Din resolved to put him in his place, Yusuf had no need even to resist. His master suddenly died, leaving as his successor an 11-year-old adolescent, al-Salih. On the 11th of July, 1174, less than 2 months later, Amalric also died, the victim of dysentery, just when he was preparing yet another invasion of Egypt, this time with the support of a powerful Sicilian fleet. He bequeathed the kingdom of Jerusalem to his son Baldwin IV, a young man of 13, afflicted by the most terrible of maledictions, leprosy. Throughout the Orient, there was but a single monarch who could stand in the way of the irresistible rise of Saladin, and that was Manuel, Emperor of the Rum, who indeed dreamed of some day becoming the suzerain of Syria, and who intended to invade Egypt in conjunction with the Frange. But then, in September 1176, as if to complete the series of gifts fate bestowed upon Saladin, the powerful Byzantine army, which had checked Nur al-Din for nearly 15 years, was crushed by Kilij Arslan II, the grandson of the first Kilij Arslan, in the Battle of Merioc-Phalon. Manuel died soon afterwards, condemning the Christian Empire in the East to sink into anarchy. Can one blame Saladin's panegyrists for detecting the hand of Providence in the succession of unexpected events? Yusuf himself never claimed credit for his good fortune. He always took care to thank, after God, my uncle Shirku and my master Nur al-Din. It is true that the greatness of Saladin lay also in his modesty. One day, when Salah al-Din was tired and was trying to rest, one of his Mamluks came to him and handed him a paper to sign. "I am exhausted," said the Sultan. "Come back in an hour." But the man insisted. He fairly stuck the page in Salah al-Din's face, saying, "Let the master sign." The Sultan replied, "But I have no inkwell here." He was seated at the entrance to his tent, and the Mamluk remarked that there was an inkwell inside. "There is an inkwell at the back of the tent," he cried, which meant, in effect, that he was ordering Salah al-Din to go and get the inkwell himself, no less. The Sultan turned, saw the inkwell, and said, "By God, you're right." He reached back, bracing himself with his left hand, and grasped the inkwell in his right. Then he signed the paper. This incident, related by Baha al-Din, Saladin's personal secretary and biographer, is a striking illustration of what made him so different from the monarchs of his time, indeed of all times. He was able to remain humble with the humble, even after he had become the most powerful of the powerful. The chroniclers, of course, evoke his courage, his sense of justice, and his zeal for the jihad, but through their writings a more touching, more human image always transpires. "One day," Baha al-Din relates, "in the midst of our campaign against the Frange, Salah al-Din summoned his close companions. In his hand was a letter he had just finished reading, and when he tried to speak, he broke down. Seeing him in this state, we were unable to hold back our own tears, even though we did not know what was the matter. Finally, his voice choked with tears, he said, 'Taqi al-Din, my nephew, is dead.' Then his warm tears began to flow again, as did ours. When I regained my composure, I said to him, 'Let us not forget the campaign in which we are engaged, and let us ask God to forgive us for having abandoned ourselves to this grief.' Salah al-Din agreed. 'Yes,' he said, 'may God forgive me. May God forgive me.' He repeated these words several times, and then he added, 'Let no one know what has happened.' Then he had rose water brought to wash his eyes." The tears of Saladin flowed on other occasions besides the deaths of those closest to him. "Once," Baha al-Din recalls, "when I was riding at the Sultan's side against the Frange, an army scout came to us with a sobbing woman beating her breast. 'She came from the Frange camp," the scout explained, "and wants to see the master. We brought her here." Salah al-Din asked his interpreter to question her. She said, "Yesterday some Muslim thieves entered my tent and stole my little girl. I cried all night, and our commanders told me, 'The king of the Muslims is merciful. We will let you go to him, and you can ask for your daughter back. Thus have I come, and I place all my hopes in you.'" Salah al-Din was touched, and tears came to his eyes. He sent someone to the slave market to look for the girl, and less than an hour later, a horseman arrived bearing the child on his shoulders. As soon as she saw them, the girl's mother threw herself to the ground and smeared her face with sand. All those present wept with emotion. She looked heavenward and began to mutter incomprehensible words. Thus was her daughter returned to her, and she was escorted back to the camp of the Frange. Those who knew Saladin say little about his physical appearance. He was small and frail, with a short, neat beard. They prefer to speak of his pensive and somewhat melancholy face, which would suddenly light up with a comforting smile that would put anyone talking to him at ease. He was always affable with visitors, insisting that they stay to eat, treating them with full honors, even if they were infidels, and satisfying all their requests. He could not bear to let someone who had come to him depart disappointed, and there were those who did not hesitate to take advantage of this quality. One day, during a truce with the Frange, the Brins, Lord of Antioch, arrived unexpectedly at Saladin's tent and asked him to return a district that the Sultan had taken 4 years earlier. And he agreed. Saladin's generosity sometimes bordered on the irresponsible. His treasurers, Baha al-Din reveals, always kept a certain sum hidden away for emergencies, for they knew that if the master learned of the existence of this reserve, he would spend it immediately. In spite of this precaution, when the Sultan died, the state treasury contained no more than an ingot of tar gold and 47 dirhams of silver. When some of his collaborators chided him for his profligacy, Saladin answered with a nonchalant smile, "There are people for whom money is no more important than sand." Indeed, he felt genuine contempt for riches and luxury, and when the fabulous palaces of the Fatimid caliphs fell into his hands, he settled his emirs in them, preferring himself to live in the more modest residence reserved for the viziers. This was but one of the many features that Saladin and Nur al-Din appeared to have in common. In fact, Saladin's adversaries saw him as no more than a pale reflection of his master. In reality, in his contacts with others, especially his soldiers, he behaved far more warmly than his predecessor had. And although he observed the letter of religious precepts, he lacked the slight streak of bigotry that the son of Zangi had manifested on occasion. In general, one may say that Saladin was as demanding of himself as Nur al-Din had been, but more lenient with others, although he was even more merciless than his elder when dealing with those who had insulted Islam, be they heretics or certain of the Frange. Beyond these differences of personality, Saladin was strongly influenced, especially at the beginning, by the imposing stature of Nur al-Din, of whom he strove to be a worthy successor, relentlessly pursuing the same objectives, to unify the Arab world and to mobilize the Muslims, both morally, with the aid of a powerful propaganda apparatus, and militarily, in order to reconquer the occupied territories, above all Jerusalem. In the summer of 1174, as the emirs of Damascus who supported young al-Salih were discussing the best way to hold out against Saladin, even considering an alliance with the Frange, the ruler of Cairo sent them a genuinely challenging letter. In it, judiciously concealing his conflict with Nur al-Din, he unhesitatingly presented himself as the continuator of his suzerain's work and the faithful guardian of his heritage. "If," he wrote, "our late king had detected among you a man as worthy of his confidence as me, would he not have entrusted him with the leadership of Egypt, the most important of his provinces? You may be sure that had Nur al-Din not died so soon, he would have designated me to educate his son and to watch over him. Now I observe you are behaving as though you alone served my master and his son, and you are attempting to exclude me. But I shall soon arrive. In honor of the memory of my master, I shall perform deeds that will have their effect, and each of you will be punished for his misconduct." Here it is difficult to recognize the circumspect man of previous years. It is as if the death of his master had unleashed long pent-up aggression. It is true that the circumstances were exceptional, for this message had a precise function. It was the declaration of war with which Saladin would begin the conquest of Muslim Syria. When he sent this message in October 1174, the ruler of Cairo was already on his way to Damascus, leading 700 cavalry. That was far too few for a siege of the Syrian metropolis, but Yusuf had carefully calculated the odds. Frightened by the uncharacteristically violent tone of Saladin's missive, al-Salih and his collaborators preferred to retreat to Aleppo. Crossing Frange territory with no difficulty via what could now be called the Shirku Trail, Saladin arrived at Damascus in late October. Supporters of his family quickly threw open the gates and welcomed him. Encouraged by this victory, won without a single sword stroke, he continued on his way. He left the Damascus garrison under the command of one of his brothers and headed for central Syria, where he seized Homs and Hama. During this lightning campaign, Ibn al-Atir tells us, "Salah al-Din claimed to be acting in the name of the king al-Salih, son of Nur al-Din. He said that his aim was to defend the country against the Frange." Still faithful to the Zangi dynasty, the Mosul historian is at least suspicious of Saladin, whom he accuses of duplicity. He was not entirely wrong. Yusuf, anxious not to act as a usurper, did indeed present himself as the protector of al-Salih. In any event, he said. This adolescent cannot govern alone. He needs a tutor, a regent, and no one is better placed than me to perform that function. He sent al-Sali letter after letter, assuring him of his loyalty, ordered prayers to be said for him in the mosques of Cairo and Damascus, and coined money in his name. The young monarch was wholly unmoved by these gestures. In December 1174, when Saladin laid siege to Aleppo, to protect King al-Sali from the nefarious influence of his advisers, the son of Nur al-Din assembled the people of the city and delivered a moving speech. Behold this unjust and ungrateful man who wishes to take my country from me without regard to God or man. I am an orphan, and I rely upon you to defend me in memory of my father who so loved you. Deeply touched, the Aleppans decided to resist the outlaw, come what may. Yusuf, seeking to avoid a direct conflict with al-Salih, lifted the siege. On the other hand, he now decided to proclaim himself king of Egypt and Syria, and would thus no longer depend on any suzerain. The chroniclers would also call him Sultan, but he himself never adopted this title. Saladin later returned several times to the walls of Aleppo, but he could never bring himself to cross swords with the son of Nur al-Din. Al-Salih's advisers decided to resort to the services of the assassins in an effort to remove this permanent threat. They made contact with Rashid al-Din Sinan, who promised to get rid of Yusuf for them. The old man of the mountains could have asked nothing better than to settle accounts with the grave digger of the Fatimid dynasty. The first assault came at the beginning of 1175. Some assassins penetrated Saladin's camp as far as his tent, where an emir recognized them and barred their way. He was seriously wounded, but the alarm had been sounded. Guards came running, and after a murderous fight, the Battinis were massacred. This only postponed matters. On the 22nd of May, 1176, when Saladin was again campaigning in the region of Aleppo, an assassin burst into his tent and dealt him a dagger stroke in the head. Fortunately, the Sultan had been on his guard since the previous attack and had taken the precaution of wearing a headdress of mail under his fez. The would-be killer then went for his victim's neck, but again his blade was checked. Saladin was wearing a long tunic of thick material, whose high collar was reinforced with mail. One of the army emirs then arrived, seized the dagger with one hand, and with the other struck the Battini, who collapsed. But before Saladin had had time to rise, a second killer leapt upon him, then a third. The guards, however, had meanwhile arrived, and the assailants were massacred. Yusuf emerged from his tent haggard and reeling, amazed that he had escaped injury. As soon as he had regained his wits, he decided to mount an attack on the lair of the assassins in central Syria, where Rashid al-Din Sinan controlled 10 or so fortresses. Saladin laid siege to the most formidable of them, Masyaf, perched on the summit of a cliff. Exactly what happened in the land of the assassins that August of 1176 will probably always remain a mystery. This book is continued on Cassette 6, Side 1.